Chapter 1. You might say the affair began when Percy Feltham put a bullet through his head in 1917, or when Jeremy Frayne and I turned up on that foggy night at the Abbey to find half the household had turned out onto the moors, or even to the scene of the second violent death on the premises a few days later. But I think for my purpose, it will be best to begin with the day I cannoned against Jeremy in the bazaar at M in India. I had just completed a fascinating but intricate piece of personal inquiry work on behalf of a rich and fanatical client of my legal firm, Hutchinson, Keith and Murray. It had involved a great deal of examination, patience, travelling, time, money, and the most minute inquiries, all to establish the falsity of a slander that scarcely seemed worth so much effort. I said as much to my senior partner, but Hutchinson is versed in humanity and possesses, in addition, a peculiar ripe wisdom of his own.
"Tell Desmond that," he said, "and he'll make the obvious retort of the almost fabulously wealthy man who has had to earn his living. He's kept his hands clean all these years, worked colossally hard, achieved most of his aims, and his good name is worth a great deal to him. He can't buy a new one, as he can replace most things. To him, this is vital. And he hasn't the advantages of birth that would enable him to shrug the lie aside for the stupid insult that it is." I had no objection to Mr. Desmond's regard for his good name, since it gave me the opportunity of visiting a country that has always possessed a charm for me, even in prospect. Moreover, after chasing from pillar to post, I ran down my slanderer, proved his bribes to certain locals and poor whites beyond a doubt, and was coming back with a fistful of evidence when I collided with Jeremy Frayne. I had known Jeremy ever since we were small boys together at our first prep school. He had been a thin, intelligent, good-looking little boy, who only had to nod his head to gain adherence to the maddest scheme. At 14, at Eton, he had been cultish, with an appearance of wearing someone else's clothes. But his personal magnetism was greater than ever. At 17, he came nearer to being expelled, without actually pulling it off, than anyone I have ever met. Three of us held our thumbs for him for an hour while his persuasive tongue tackled its first serious task at diplomacy, and after that he was the rowdiest undergraduate on record to escape being sent down. Wherever Jeremy was, there was bound to be something going on. Some madcap had only got to say, "What a lark to do so-and-so," and Jeremy would be up and calling, "Come on!" before anyone could protest. The trouble was that his challenges were always irresistible, and he seldom lost his bet. Whenever I see the Mikado, I am reminded of Jeremy when Coco says pleadingly, "When your Majesty orders a thing, it is as good as done. To all intents and purposes, that thing is done." I remember during his second year at Oxford, he got involved in a scrape that made a certain popular hostess remark that she wasn't going to have that dissolute young man at her house again. A distinct miss for Jeremy, who was accustomed to having a pretty good time there. 3 days later, there came to call on Mrs. D, a plumpish, beshawled, button-booted lady in black, giving a general appearance of feathers and brooches and carrying a large brocade bag. She had come, she explained earnestly, to apologize for the ill behavior of her son.
"He is wild," she acknowledged, "but he has a heart of gold."
Mrs. D was so won over by the old lady's skittish and witty conversation, once the question of Jeremy was shelved, that she readily agreed to rescind her decision, and the visitor retired to a neighboring garage to deal with stays, petticoats, suspenders, hairpins, and a lace fichu. The affair leaked out, though it never travelled so far as Mrs. D. When Jeremy's mother heard of it, she sent for him. She was a round, dimpled dormouse of a woman, with a deceptive air of gentleness.
"Don't you be taken in, Tony, old son," Jeremy said, feelingly to me. "I give you my word that school lickings were nothing to my mother when she got her monkey up."
Of course, at 22, she couldn't deal so simply with him, but her subtlety made even her victim her admirer.
"Dear me, Jeremy," she said in her charming voice and assuming her most...